Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure tonight to introduce Chris Jennings, the author of Paradise Now, a very interesting look at five utopian communities from the 19th century and what happened to them, what became of them. The idea is, I mean, this is something that people are fascinated with over lots of time. It'd be great to write a book on the utopian communities that succeeded, but it would probably be over the last 5,000 years, but it probably would, you know, be a short pamphlet, if that. Well, Chris Jennings.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Does this sound right? Can you hear me? This podium was invented before people had water bottles, I guess. Thank you for that great introduction. It was excellent to hear a little bit about Thomas More, and I think I'll be coming back for that talk. It sounds great. And so good evening, and thank you all for coming out. I wanted to begin by talking a little bit about the key term here, utopianism, and sort of what we are talking about when we talk about utopia. And after a little bit of that, I'm going to read a short excerpt of the book, sort of zoom in on a particular day and moment in American history, in the history of American utopianism, before returning to a sort of general discussion of American utopianism. The word utopia and utopianism is slippery. It's been used so many different times in so many different contexts that it's effectively lost any coherent meaning, which doesn't stop almost everyone from having an opinion about it or a mental image that they correspond to that concept of utopia. I had no idea when I started writing this book that on an almost daily basis, people would be coming up to me with suggestions saying, oh, I went to this very utopian summer camp, you should write about that, or are you writing about Occupy Wall Street, or I used to live in a utopian community, you know, there were three of us in an apartment and we ate a lot of lentils. And I think that is important for the discussion that I'd like to have and for the book to focus on a sort of more specific definition of the term utopia and something that is at once narrower but also, to my mind, much grander definition. As we just learned, the word derives from a book written in 1516, exactly 500 years ago, by Thomas More when he was a young man. He was later, of course, promoted from just regular Thomas More to Sir Thomas More, and then in 1935, the Vatican promoted him once again to Saint Thomas More. But at the time he wrote the book, he was basically a middling diplomat. And he, like most 16th century churchmen, More wrote in Latin, but to sort of entertain himself while he wrote and to amuse his clever friends, he filled the book with little Greek puns. And the title of the book and the name of the fictional nation that is the centerpiece of the book is itself a pun. So the second half of the word, the topos, comes from the Greek, as in topography, meaning place. But the prefix can go one of two ways. On paper, written with a U, that's the Latin transliteration that would negate what it precedes. So utopia means not a place or no place. But sounded out, if the U sound in Greek would be EU, and that's like in euphoria, meaning good. So utopia, as More intended it, and this pun very much infuses the book, is simultaneously no place and the good place or the great place. And this tension sort of hovers over the whole history of utopianism. Is utopia, and when we talk about utopia, are we talking about an actual goal, a place that we can conceivably get to, and an actual program for living, or are we talking about an illusion, an idea that at best is just a way of organizing our grievances with the world in which we live? The sense in which I use the word and in which most people use the word when they refer to experimental communities owes less to More than to Marx and Engels, Engels in particular, and they use the word to distinguish their own brand of what they were calling scientific socialism from a set of theorists that preceded them historically, who they classified all as utopian socialists. And Marx and Engels had a fair amount of respect for these people, as evidenced by how much time they spent writing about them. But utopian socialism was not conceived of as a term of praise. It was a way of sort of deriding earlier socialism, which these people thought of as somehow sort of, which Marx and Engels thought of as somehow fundamentally bourgeois, because both it depended on wealthy benefactors for this sort of socialism to function, and Marx and Engels at least thought that it appealed really to the tastes of the bourgeoisie rather than to the proletariat. I'm going to be drinking an awful lot of water. So in the Communist Manifesto, they famously mock the utopian utopian socialism of their predecessors, and in doing so, they actually name names. They list a bunch of theorists, and those are the people that I write about, and those are the people who had such an impact in the United States during the 19th century, and the people who, the theorists who, to my mind, most clearly deserve the title utopian. So now I'm just going to zoom in away from theory to an actual day in history, and then we'll return to the concept of utopia. So there's an epigraph here from the book of Revelation. The sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood. At noon, darkness spread across the sky. It was the 19th of May, 1780, a Friday. On the rolling pasture land of western New England, sheep and cows lay down one by one in the damp grass. As the darkness became total, finches and warblers quieted and returned to their roosts. Above the white pines and budding oaks, bats stirred. Mistaking day for night, they took wing. The fratricidal war for American independence was grinding into its fifth year. A week earlier, the Continental Army had surrendered the smoldering port of Charleston to the British Navy after more than a month of heavy shelling. In New England, with so many young men off fighting, gardens went unplanted, and the wheat grew thin. For many colonists, the war with Great Britain aroused a stolid nationalist piety, a consoling faith in what they called the sacred cause of liberty, the belief that Providence would guide the rebels to victory, and that the fighting itself constituted an appeal to heaven. But in the hilly borderland between New York and Massachusetts, the anxiety and austerity of the long conflict inspired frenzied revival meetings. This was the new light stir, an aftershock of the great awakening of radical Protestantism that had coursed through New England in the 1740s. From makeshift pulpits, the new light evangelists shouted an urgent millenarian message. These are the latter days. The kingdom is at hand. Standing at the crack of American independence, these backwoods Yankees believed that they were living the final hours of human history. It is written, he will come back and the righteous will be delivered from sin for 1,000 years of earthly peace and happiness. The New Lights believed that the time had come and that their small revivals, held in fields and cowsheds, would trigger the return of Christ and the millennium of heaven on earth. Looking up from their plows and their milking stools, these hill country farmers scanned the horizon for signs of his approach. In this atmosphere of millennial anticipation, days of war and rumors of war, the sudden midday blackness was an indisputable sign of the times. As New England and eastern New York were plunged into total darkness, nervous farmers lit smoky, fat-smelling candles just to eat their lunch or read a few lines of scripture. Lacking telegraphy, they were left to assume that the unnatural darkness had enveloped the whole globe. Quote, people came out wringing their hands and howling. The day of judgment has come, recalled a young rebel fifer. Nobody could say for sure when or if the blackness would pass and the light return. A doctor in New Hampshire tried to get an empirical grip on the situation. Quote, a sheet of white paper held within a few inches of the eyes, he wrote by candlelight, was equally invisible with the blackest velvet. Others turned to familiar stories for illumination. The black sky echoed the plague of darkness that God summoned over Pharaoh's Egypt. Or it was a reprise of the midday eclipse that supposedly occurred while Christ hung suffering on Calvary. Even in the rational precincts of the Connecticut legislature, the sudden blackness stirred apocalyptic thinking. When the darkness forced the House of Representatives in Hartford to adjourn, Colonel Abraham Davenport stayed at his desk and asked that candles be brought into the State House. If the day of judgment was at hand, he announced, he wished to be found at his work. Near dawn the next day, the moon finally came out. A day passed full, it shone red. A month before the darkness, Talmage Bishop and Reuben Wright, a pair of New Light revivalists from New Lebanon, New York, were walking west along a wooded footpath just north of Albany. passing through a remote territory known as Niskayuna, they happened upon a low, boggy homestead. Hoping to rest their feet and catch some food, they knocked on the door of the rough two-story cabin. Inside, they were surprised to discover a crowd, 5 men and 7 women living together in the small building. These were the Shaking Quakers, a raggedy sect from Manchester, England, gathered around a short, 44-year-old mystic named Anne Lee. Lee, whom her mothers addressed as Mother, invited the travelers in. Bishop and Wright lived nearby, but they had never heard any mention of these people. The Shakers had been in the area for 6 years, but they had maintained a low profile. They had good reason. The Hudson River, which linked British-controlled Canada and the forts of the Adirondacks to the vital port in New York City, was of great strategic importance. The surrounding Hudson Valley was a hotbed of royalist counter-revolution. Improvised rebel militias were on hair-trigger guard against Tory sabotage. It was a dangerous place to have your commitment to the revolution questioned. In this paranoid atmosphere, Lee and her followers had kept their eccentric faith and Mancunian accents to themselves. The Shakers fed the two travelers while Mother Anne explained her unusual gospel. She told the men that the millennium they and other new lights had been furiously calling down from heaven had already begun. Its promised life of sinless perfection was free for the taking. The next morning, Bishop and Wright hurried back across the Hudson to New Lebanon. They brought their tale of an ethereal blue-eyed woman living in the wilderness to their minister, a popular New Light revivalist named Joseph Meacham. Meacham, a tall, grave young man who had left the Baptist church to preach the new millenarian faith, had been leading revival meetings in New Lebanon for most of the past year. In the barn of a wealthy convert, he would whip his congregation to great heights of spiritual excitement. As he called out the good news of the coming paradise and the need for immediate surrender to the Holy Spirit, his audience trembled, stamped their feet in the straw, and let loose flurries of glossolalia. The kinetic enthusiasm of Meacham's revival could not hold. His message, like the message of other revivalists throughout New York and New England, was one of bated anticipation. Paradise or apocalypse is imminent. But nothing happened. The fall of 1779 closed into winter, winter opened onto spring, and still the world had not ended. The new lights had been primed for cataclysm. Fire from the sky, the Son of Man swinging a golden sword, the descent of the holy city of New Jerusalem. Instead, the long, hard days of spring planting started up again. Having screamed their millenarian faith until they were hoarse, many new lights felt adrift. After hearing Bishop and Wright's account of the woman called Mother, Meacham dispatched his friend Calvin Harlow to investigate. A few days later, Harlow returned to New Lebanon, spellbound. Meacham himself then set out on foot for Niskayuna. And that is when the sky went black. In her cabin in Niskayuna, Anne Lee interpreted the Egyptian darkness as a divine signal that the time had come to open her gospel to the people of the New World. When Meacham walked up the trail, Lee greeted him warmly. She said she had been expecting him. Sitting with the Shakers in their cramped cabin, Meacham quizzed them about their claim to have discovered the true nature of salvation. Had they really triumphed over sin? How was it possible that they were led against the unambiguous teachings of St. Paul by a woman? Something in the serene eloquence of their responses convinced Meacham that he was among a godly people. He converted that day. Mother Anne anointed him her firstborn son in America. Within a decade, thousands of Americans regarded Anne Lee, the scrawny daughter of a Manchester blacksmith, as the second coming of Christ. Eventually, more than 20,000 people across much of the United States would live in the society she founded. The vision Mother Anne offered them of an immaculate New World Zion, an austere, celibate, communistic paradise, inspired wave upon wave of Americans to come, as they like to say, out of the world. The opening of the Shaker Gospel in the weeks after what came to be called the Dark Day represents the start of a remarkable chapter in the history of the United States. A long, sunny season of American utopianism. So now we'll return to the broader issue, but just to give you a flavor of both the book and how these people were conducting themselves on a day-to-day basis. Okay, so one of the reasons that I think it's useful to study utopian ideas of the past is that utopia itself is diagnostic. Whatever people describe as their utopia at any given moment in history tells us things about their suffering, their anxieties, what they wanted. You know, for instance, the sort of plow-broken Russian serf puts his utopia on the Rock Candy Mountain, where there's rivers flow with beer and everything is easy. The harried, well-fed San Franciscan imagines that her utopia being somewhere where she can go learn to drive a plow up in Mendocino County. So you have this effect whereby if you look at what someone has imagined as utopia, you'll see what they were feeling about their immediate surroundings. America in the middle of the 19th century was more crowded, in my view, with utopian experimentation and utopian longing than any other place in history. So really quickly, I'd like to talk a little bit about who the American utopians of this era were and what their dreams reveal about the time in which they lived. And I'll just give, as was already mentioned, I chronicle five different groups, and I'll just give a very quick thumbnail sketch. The Shakers, you just heard a little bit about, they come here in 1774. They organize their life around this total communism. They build these very austere and very beautiful communities. Their central doctrine, and the one for which they're most famous, is that Annley had a revelation saying that the millennium had commenced and the only thing keeping it from really kicking into gear was the fact that humans were still having sex. And once we cease to have sex, the promised redemption that's described in the prophetic books of the Bible will kick in. And the Shakers did a remarkable job building these communistic communities, and they influenced everyone who followed them. It's difficult to exaggerate or overstate how much they influenced their predecessors, including across the Atlantic. Marx and Engels both paid very close attention to the Shakers and used them as evidence of the viability of a society without property. Around in the 1820s, when the Shakers are nearing their demographic peak, a very wealthy Welshman named Robert Owen, who's a socialist and a textile magnate, and a strong admirer of the Shakers, decides that he can do the same thing but without all the religious mumbo-jumbo. So he decides to come over here and basically imitate the Shakers, and he buys a community on the Wabash River in Indiana, which he dubs New Harmony, and about 1,000 people convene to build what he calls the New Moral World, which will be a secular, rationalist utopia. It doesn't go so great. Owen retreats to England towards the end of the 1820s, and the collapse of New Harmony was so well publicized that there's sort of a chill in utopian experimentation, but there continue to be Owenite study groups in every American city, and a couple of small little Owenite communities are formed. And then in the 1840s, a young, well-to-do New Yorker named Albert Brisbane travels to France and becomes turned on by the ideas of this French social theorist named Charles Fourier, who has an incredibly elaborate scheme for how we are gonna create a paradise of the globe. And he believes that history is inevitably tending towards a state that he calls harmony, where everything will be wonderful and there'll be abundance and everyone will have lots of sex and it's just going to be a blast. And so Fourier believes that the way to get to this paradisical state is for us all to gather in communities of 1,620 people. Precisely, he's really big on numerical precision. And Albert Brisbane, this young American, is blown away by these ideas. He thinks he's seen a divine truth, and he travels back to New York, and he does an amazing job propagandizing on behalf of Fourierism, and almost 29 and then a few sort of half-cocked efforts are established, and they're called phalanxes, Fouriers, these 1,600-person communities in which life is going to be so great. So there's about 29 phalanxes established throughout the country, the most famous of which is the Brook Farm Phalanx, which a lot of people maybe remember from high school. It was home to some of the sort of leading lights of the New England literary renaissance. Hawthorne was a member. Emerson was a regular guest. At the end of the 1840s, more French communists come to the United States. They come to Texas under the leadership of a man named Étienne Cabet. They call themselves the Icarians. Cabet, like Thomas More, had written a utopian novel. He is strongly influenced by More. And he describes this happy communist society called Icaria, in which everyone's completely equal and everything's run by the state, and it's sort of a techno-paradise. He has a lot of hopes for how the new industrial technologies are going to create abundance. And so his followers come to Texas. They have a terrible time in Texas, but then they buy the city from the Mormons as they retreat, the Latter-day Saints, as they retreat west from Illinois. They buy the Mormon city of Nauvoo, and they do pretty well there for a while, and eventually they move to Iowa. And the final gasp of American Icarianism is not far from here in Cloverdale. There's a small, very short-lived Icarian community. The last community I write about, all of these preceding communities had begun. The theorists had been European and the practitioners had been American. This last community is entirely homegrown. The Oneida community, which is the one that I find people tend to know the most about because it's also taught in AP high school history, their leading doctrine was, like the Shakers, they believed that the millennium described in the prophetic books of the Bible had actually begun and that we just had to sort of arrange human society in the right way. The Shakers thought that that meant ceasing to have sex. The Oneida community took a different approach. They had a lot of sex. And basically they instituted a practice called complex marriage, which was a form of free love in which basically any woman in the community could sleep with any man. They did remarkably well. They made a ton of money with some very successful manufacturing enterprises and survived until the late 1870s when they sort of came unraveled for a number of complicated reasons. Anyway, those are the five groups that we're dealing with, and that's not everyone. There were more communities in the 19th century, but those were the big names, and I think that through them, the story of American utopianism can be told. They cover the whole thing. And I think it's important to just quickly say what they had in common, which is they were all more or less communist. They believed that in the ideal society, private property would cease to exist and work would be cooperative. They all more or less believed in the abolition of the family, that the traditional nuclear biological family unit was an obsolete, archaic institution that was slowing humanity's ascent into paradise. And so they all, through various means, tried to dissolve the traditional family unit. And of course, they were most united by their utopianism. They all believed that the society in which they lived required a complete overhaul, not incremental change, not progress, complete reinvention, starting with chucking everything that we take for granted as sort of the basic building blocks of civilization. And they also all believed that the way of effecting this change was to build seminal communities that would be so attractive and so successful that other people would see them and immediately imitate their scheme. And they really were optimistic that in a matter of decades, these systems would spread across the whole globe and the whole world would be transformed, which, as we know, did not happen. So the question that really drives my research into these people, because when you read their diaries and their memoirs, they're incredibly smart, sane, rational people. Some of the most prescient reformers of their day. How did those people come to hold, such reasonable people come to hold such incredibly unreasonable ideas about the future and about our ability to create the future? And I think the answer to that question lies in particular circumstances of the middle 19th century, especially in the United States. Little comedy for you. So basically what you have is a confluence of two very different sounding ideas that actually end up fitting together quite nicely. One is this essentially mystical idea, this Judeo-Christian proposition that history is bookended by utopias, right? In the beginning, we're in a garden, we're naked, there's fruit, it's fabulous. And then at the end, we're going to live in, at least as the New Testament describes it, a sort of prefab city of New Jerusalem, which God will lower down to earth and will live there happily for 1,000 years. And this idea that we've already experienced the garden part and we're going towards the city. And so that's essentially a mystical proposition, but it holds a lot of sway. And it's hard to overstate the extent to which that idea infused even sort of mainstream Protestant life in America in the 19th century, because it, for most of us, I think sounds pretty wild now that the world is about to be transformed by a supernatural force. And as an aside, I should say that the inverse of that idea, the technical term for that, eschatology just means the theology of end times. The technical term for that eschatology is that these people mostly had was post-millenarianism, which basically is called post because they believe that first the world will be perfected and then all that nasty stuff described in the book of Revelation will happen afterwards. The leading theology of the last 100 years in the United States, particularly evangelical Christians, is what is usually called pre-millenarian eschatology, which basically just means they think all the bloody, messy stuff is going to come first, and then we'll have that 1,000 years of peace and abundance. And it's a small interpretation of a couple of prophetic books in the Bible, but it actually, if you think about it, is transformative to how you experience the world. Either the next thing on the calendar is an apocalyptic war between good and evil, where the non-believers are dying in droves, or the next thing on the calendar is a millennium of sharing and peace and prosperity. And depending on what you think is coming next really orients how you treat the world. And the people I'm talking about, the post-millenarians, they basically came to think that the mechanism by which God was going to affect this remarkable change was through them. They were going to, the city of New Jerusalem wasn't going to be lowered down from above, it was going to be built by right-thinking Americans. And so that's this mystical strain of thought, which is very powerful at the time. And then you have a completely different but very related idea that comes out of the late Enlightenment, which is, as people who then held it described it as totally rational, not mystical, which is that progress is just the nature of history. And every decade, the world is going to get a little bit better because we're getting more clever and old superstitions are fading and burning off under the rising sun of enlightenment. And the Industrial Revolution really sort of supercharged this thinking because though it was a little messy at first, people thought, wow, look, a machine can now do what 100 men used to, what it used to take 100 men to do. Clearly, in a few years, we're going to be living in a society of overwhelming abundance and very little labor. And simultaneous to that is this belief that not only are we getting smarter and our material circumstances are improving, which was certainly true, but this belief that human virtue is also growing and that new ideas like that maybe everyone's kind of more or less equal in some fundamental way, and maybe slavery is not such a great idea, and maybe torture is unacceptable. These sort of what they imagine to be sort of new propositions, and again, it's worth saying that this is more in theory than in practice. People were still being jerks the way they've always been. This was a very powerful idea. So you've got this secular idea of progress and this mystical idea of the coming millennium, and they fuse very powerfully. And it's a little hard for us now, I think, to see how that fusion can happen because there's not a lot of rapport in our lives between, say, people who talk about science and people who talk about the end times. Those are different groups, but that was not so much the case. Mainstream Protestants talked about this, and I'm reminded, I think, about a week ago, probably not at this very podium, but maybe, is there one of these in Silicon Valley? The Commonwealth Club. E.J. Dionne was speaking, the Washington Post reporter. Someone from the audience asked him, who were his political heroes, and he gave a very warm shout out to John Quincy Adams, which warmed my heart because I'm a big fan. And Adams basically is the perfect embodiment, and I think really helps a modern reader understand this effect, because he's talking about he's basically, the language didn't apply then, but he's sort of a progressive. He wants the federal government to be raising taxes to build a lot of stuff for people to help the American economy. And he's describing this stuff in explicitly millenarian terms. He's going to Congress saying, we need to build a new canal and we need to raise this much money because we must fulfill the trembling hope of the Christian for the coming millennium. So it's this sort of like mixture of this very mystical idea and a very practical progressive conception of how the world is going to work. Should have brought a straw. Okay, so just to quickly revisit this sort of enlightenment idea of progress, at the time, it sounds a little naive to us now, this notion that the world just gets better every year. But at the time, there was a lot of reason to think this. Republicanism had taken firm root in the New World. This is right after the American Revolution. It was starting to germinate in Europe. Industrial technologies were booming. That thinking, especially for people in Europe, was sort of supercharged by the mute, huge, silent presence of the North American continent, which they imagined as more or less this blank slate, which of course it wasn't, but they had this conception that here was a place where history can be restarted. And now, just at the moment where we've got all this newfound cleverness, we've got God has revealed to us this big empty canvas, and we can go to North America and we can build the society that we have always been meant to live in, free from sort of the ancient religious and political struggles of Europe. So these let me just, okay, so there's a wonderful quote that I came upon just the other day that sort of gets at how pervasive this thinking that the world, that the millennium was coming was, and because it's kind of hard for us to understand, writing in the New York Tribune in 1840, this very mainstream, I mean, not mainstream, but very popular abolitionist named John Collins was able to write in the leading newspaper in America on the front page, you know, that the paradise of Eden is to be regained at some period or other, there are but few who doubt. It was sort of a proposition that most Americans could agree with, that there was some kind of paradise coming. So I'd like to, so that we can have a little time for back and forth, I'm going to maybe jump ahead and return to a sort of more general question about why we should bother with these people, why we should be talking about them, why I just spent several years of my life with them. You know, what's in it for us, basically. And I think that one of the reasons that it's worthwhile to explore this particular chapter of American history is that Americans, who have a shorter past than most nations, tend to use our history for political ends. You know, we are constantly, if you watch the GOP debates more than the Bernie and Hillary going at it, you see this repeated allusion to a sort of imagined American past. And we have a sort of monolithic narrative about American history. And I think it's important to sort of complicate that story and sort of weird up our own history. You know, all of this action that I'm talking about is happening during what's usually called the Jacksonian era, which is a particular moment in American history that I think people associate with the origin of certain American ideas, westward expansion, sort of rugged individualism, whatever was better than wimpy individualism, I guess, free market capitalism. These ideas are flourishing and really growing during the Jacksonian era. And I think it's important to remember that simultaneous to all of that, you had people, many, many Americans, advocating for socialism, for sexual liberation, for feminism. You know, the Fourierists were talking about a future in which the state would organize orgies for everybody. So there's the past is more complicated than we tend to remember it. And since we use our past for political ends, I think it's important to have a more complicated story. And just as an illustration of that, if you can imagine, when Robert Owen, he's the guy that founded the community in New Harmony, he comes over in 1824. He's invited to Washington in 1825, and he basically speaks over the course of 10 days twice, 9 days in between, to a joint session of Congress, the Supreme Court, outgoing President Monroe, incoming President, President-elect John Quincy Adams. They all come out twice. During the interval between his two speeches, Adams becomes president, but Monroe, even though he's just finished the presidency, comes back to hear Robert Owen give like 4-hour lectures on the merits of communism and the absurdity of revealed religion. He was a very avid atheist. So it's important to, you know, I think that was surely the first and last time that the entire federal government had assembled to sort of politely listen to hours-long lecture on communism and the absurdity of religion, and then to invite the guy back the next week to do it again. So I think this, you know, people might have thought he was naive, and surely many of them did, but you could still talk about these ideas in the United States without being shouted out of the room. Another reason that I think we can benefit from spending time with these strange but kind of familiar Americans is that they can help us get back in the habit of what they spent all their time doing, which was thinking creatively about the future. And I think that there's an inherent virtue in utopian thinking. And I'm going to read just a very short excerpt to sort of maybe wrap things up a little bit that gets at that. The title of this section, by the way, I stole from a bumper sticker that my good friends over here have, which is "The Future Ain't What It Used to Be." So thank you very much, Dave and Hannah. There's an epigraph here, which two epigraphs I'll read very quickly. One is from the poet Jack Gilbert from a poem called Failing and Flying. And the line is, "Everyone forgets that Icarus also flew." And then the other is a little snippet of the Republic, which Plato's Republic, which is a discourse on the nature of the ideal state. And this is Socrates talking to his interlocutor, Glaucon. Glaucon says, "I understand. You mean that the just person will be willing to take part in the politics of the city we were founding and describing, the one that exists in theory, for I don't think it exists anywhere on earth. Socrates responds. But perhaps there is a model of it in heaven for anyone who wants to look at it and to make himself a citizen on the strength of what he sees. It makes no difference whether it is or ever will be somewhere, for he would take part in the practical affairs of that city and no other. And just a little more. Without fantasies about the shape of things to come, we are as likely to be led into the future by the almost random process of technological innovation as anything else. Invention mothers necessity, and material progress lurches rudderless, indifferent to anything higher than than convenience or the restless appetite for quick satisfactions. As Emerson famously put it in an ode to the Fourierist minister, William Henry Channing, things are in the saddle and ride mankind. Our present material abundance exceeds even the most fantastical daydreams of the 19th century utopians. A working-class American suburb offers comforts that would stupefy any citizen of the fictional Icaria. But who would call that suburb paradise? Quote, while we are pouring ever-increasing intellectual efforts into improving our means, we seem to have given no thoughts to the ends we serve, wrote the French philosopher Bertrand de Jouvenel. Every year we are better armed to achieve what we want, but what do we want? Uncoupled from utopian ends, even the most incisive social critique falls short. Imagining idealized future, unburdened by worldly cynicism, begins as a way to catalog social ills and to sift out those values that matter most. But unlike other modes of critique, utopian thinking and experimentation goes further, inevitably generating its own solidarity and enthusiasm, thereby stimulating the numberless private exertions that add up to social progress. The 19th century utopians, starveling picnics though many of them were, demonstrate how a thoroughly elaborated vision of a better world can move a diverse group of people in a single direction. Myths and stories about the past give coherence and energy to a polity. A story about the future, a plot to be fulfilled, can do the same. When the citizens of New Harmony or Icaria believed that utopia was on the horizon, they labored together with remarkable energy, channeling their separate ambitions into a shared vision. Quote, we all work with tireless zeal, wrote a young Icarian named Peck, who was assigned to the laundry. We are doing everything for the love of humanity rather than the love of money. There is no limit to our desire to work. Once the collective vision began to fade, its power became obvious. Suddenly, the work was heavier, the soup tasted thinner, and the annoyances were more annoying. As Socrates suggests toward the end of the Republic, the mere contemplation of an ideal polis is a civic act, a means of accessing social and moral truths that might otherwise be obscured by the overwhelming material reality of the world around us. Some of the things that the 19th century utopians got right, decades in advance of their fellow citizens, the equality of women, the importance of public education in a democratic society, the need for a social safety net, the edifying vitality of a diverse society, the hazards of unchecked markets, show the social dividends of contemplating idealized futures with a relatively soft commitment to the present state of affairs. The 19th century utopians did not carry the day. They thought that the world was on the cusp of renewal. They were wrong. The big wooden dormitories were boarded up. The collective gardens went to seed. The loud, merry dining rooms sank into silence. And the sea, despite Fourier's harmonic arithmetic, does not yet taste like lemonade. Their disregard for the world as it is guaranteed that they didn't survive long. Our disregard for the world as it might be could prove just as grave. So I'll stop there and we can have some questions.
I'd like to remind our online audiences that they are listening to Chris Jennings, the author of Paradise Now, speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Now it's time for questions and answers. One comment, it's very interesting that you mentioned the fact that life is more complicated, so that our history is more complicated than we like to make it. Everything kind of, it's interesting because they project out, the utopians project out to the future a simplified version of the future, and we take the history and we make it a simplified version of the history, which goes together. I've always thought that when encouraging people to try to accomplish something great, that they should be aware of how complicated the past was at which time anything great was accomplished, because a lot of people feel it's only when things are simple that something great can be accomplished. It's the same process, you know.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that Americans in particular have made a sort of utopia of their past, and it serves a similar function that utopianism has served elsewhere, which is it's sort of this white wall on which we project whatever we like or don't like about the present. So the past is everything that we find lacking in the present, which obviously is not true.
Yeah, makes it hard to have a basis on which to have progress, right?
Did all these societies end pretty much the same way for the same reasons, or did they all die for other?
They did not all die of the same cause. No, they all died in their own special ways. I would say that if there was a common symptom that they all suffered, some of them died for very different reasons. A few died of poverty, obviously. Some of them inversely died of having too much wealth. The Oneida community and the Shakers did so well that they got very anxious about letting new members in, because they thought people weren't going to really be true believers. They were just jumping on board now that the stones had been lifted out of the field and they were having steak every night. So the Shakers didn't eat steak. But I think the moment in which you can see all of them starting to die, is the moment in which it happens very rapidly, when the dream ceases to look like it's about to happen. That effect allowed them, I mean, this is hard work. They're in the wilderness building a society from nothing. It's incredibly hard labor. The moment that the dream no longer looks assured, people start quarreling, they start going their separate ways, money goes missing, the thing kind of unravels. So as long as the dream is sort of there, people would put up with amazing hardships and quite happily.
So I came today being interested in this history because I consider myself in some ways kind of a modern utopian, maybe without the blinders, in the sense of wanting a radical remake of society, not just being content with tinkering around the edges. So I was a little bit disappointed to hear you using what I call the nationalist we, sort of referring to Americans as with a personal pronouns, and like this is this group of people, when I feel that the main thing preventing utopian experiments today are the national governments of the world, and this practice that they have of monopolizing all the land and not allowing people to form their own independent communities. The startup barrier, and to put this in sort of tech corporate terms, to starting a new country is extremely high. The governments of the world have kind of a closed club in the United Nations, and it exists on the basis of discriminating on the basis of nationality, nationalism, which I think is just as wrong as racism, sexism, homophobia, and so forth. So I'd like to maybe hear your comments on that and on some of the efforts to get around that, like seasteading. Of those of you heard of the Seasteading Institute, seasteading.org, having new countries out on the open ocean as one of the last unclaimed areas on Earth where you could potentially start a new community with its own rules, free of existing controls.
Yeah, I think seasteading is fascinating, and you're absolutely right that the moment in which what I've been talking about is what I really think is the golden age of American utopianism, when there was more of this thinking and it was more extreme than it has been at any point. People always say, well, what about the 1960s? And I think that there's some fundamental differences, but one of the things that, as you rightly pointed out, that allowed this to flourish was that the federal government was, you know, if anyone wanted a big chunk of Iowa, you could have it, and there was less of a nationalistic sense. These people probably identified more or less as Americans, but that had become a far less pervasive concept than it is today. And I apologize for using the nationalist we. I think you're absolutely right that it certainly points conversations in a particular direction.
How does biology play into this and the demise of utopianism, in that we all seem to still want to be individuals, which creates competition, which does not then play into that?
Yeah. I mean, that is sort of the... I think every utopian community at some point becomes a referendum on human nature, right? Like, are people fundamentally good, or are people fundamentally evil, or at least fundamentally not good? And these people were certainly contending with that, and they, for the most part, had a rather positive view of human nature, which I think I also do. But One of the interesting parts of this history that speaks to what you're talking about is Charles Fourier's whole system was built on this idea of individuals competing with one another, but they were just competing with one another in these sort of creative ways. Like they would, every day would be like, who can pick more pears? And that way they'd always have a lot of pears, you know? So he was really wanted to harness the competitive human nature in the interest of abundance for all. Others had a more saccharine view of human nature and thought, no, you know, you just put everyone in the same job and they'll be happy. And we've seen that that doesn't generally play out very well.
Hi, I want to make a comment to Starman about having an independently governed community in the United States. In The Economist this week, New Hampshire is promoting that exact kind of society, and they're inviting people that want to live outside of the tenets of modern governments to move to New Hampshire. So you might look into that. Now, my question is, my question is,
so cold.
On a bigger scale, I have this concept that your belief system is determined by your food supply. And I would like you to address that. Philosophers don't necessarily bring that into their philosophies, but pragmatism plays a big role in your belief system.
Mm-hmm. These philosophers definitely brought it in, and they probably spent more time writing about food than anything else. And they all had different ideas. The Fourierists experimented with eating 8 meals a day. They ate very specific foods. The Shakers and some of the others were often devotees of Sylvester Graham, who was a very influential man in the middle of the 19th century, the father of the Graham cracker. And they had this sort of idea about, they were mostly vegetarian and ate whole grains. And the foods that we actually now tend to associate with communalism were that sort of like cold water and whole grain thing from the 70s was actually also happening in the 1840s. For whatever reason, people tend to associate communal living with this sort of coarse diet. Yeah, so Sylvester Graham, and which is why the Shakers took up his diet with great gusto, there was this sort of poorly worked out notion of inflammation, and it applied both to the body and to the mind. So you know, a spicy food would excite you, and bland graham cracker would leave you perfectly contented without any sex.
I always had a certain amount of fascination for social movements that somewhere in their development, they decide that they have some kind of utopian vision. So you made reference to different groups in the 60s, whether it be hippie communes or to even things like Synanon, who think we're the harbinger to something that's going to completely revolutionize the way people interact with each other. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if these groups that you're describing in the 19th century, was there a tipping point where they just started out as feeling like, oh, we're on to something, where they crystallized into like, we're the real deal and we're going to completely reform society?
I would say that for the most part, they started with the belief that they were the real deal who was going to reform society. There was a religious quality to these belief systems, even the ones that were expressly secular, that they'd stumbled into what more than one of them referred to as a divine code, sort of like a... And this was an extension of what I was talking about a little bit, the late Enlightenment idea that we're figuring out the... You know, we've just discovered Newtonian physics, and suddenly we understand why billiard balls and the stars move in the way they do. And there was a thinking that a similar sort of science or calculus of human nature could be discovered. But that idea has fallen out of favor, but they believed that there was in the same way that they had just discovered principles that govern chemistry, for instance, the equally reliable mathematical system for human nature was soon to be discovered, and some of these people thought that they had discovered it. So they didn't allow for too much ambiguity in their beliefs. They thought that they had the system and that was it. Yeah.
Other questions? The companies or the institutions that lasted seem to have developed a business of some kind, you know, that you know, just like some Trappist monks create jam and then mm-hmm. that helps support them. But did any of them start with the idea we're going to support this all with one kind of business or not? Or did it just develop over time that they fell into that?
Yeah, it developed over time. There was sort of a sweet spot in technological progress wherein a utopian community was a great economic unit. There was before industrialism had fully taken hold, there was this moment where if you lived in a community of 100 people, you could have your own sawmill. So there was enough wood to be milled that you didn't have to go pay someone to have your sawmill. You could have your own grain mill. And whereas all of the sort of what they would call isolated, they referred to the people outside of their community as isolated, the isolated farmers around them would go have to pay for all of those services. So, and there was a moment where 10 Shaker women making bonnets could be a lot more effective, economies of scale and whatnot, than 10 separate farmers' wives making bonnets. And then eventually they were both replaced by factory-made bonnets, and the economic benefits of that sort of small size collective ceased to exist. But you know, in both the two really successful businesses, the communities that had successful businesses, the Shakers and the Oneida community, they attributed their success to their collectivism, and their success was also a testament to how people thought of them. It was sort of, you know, in a time before brands, right, you'd go to the local country store and they'd have a keg of molasses and a shovel or whatever, and you don't know who made this stuff. And certain things, you know, you can look at a chair and decide if it's a good chair or not, but other things like vegetable seed, which was the Shaker's first real boom business, you have no way of knowing if it's good vegetable seed or not because we don't yet have burpee seeds or whatever. So the name Shaker stamped on an envelope became synonymous with quality and the sort of, because they were very religious, a certain virtue. They weren't going to stiff you on the seeds. So that also gave them a real advantage, that people thought well of them. Even the Oneida community, which if you go to a home or to a restaurant and flip over a plate or cutlery, you might see the name Oneida stamped on it. It's still a thriving interest in it, and it was, you know, it grew right out of the Oneida community. They started making animal traps and then silverware. And they also got very lucky because they were making animal traps right during the boom in the fur trade. They had already started, and then we bought Alaska, and they made it. A lot of traps.
Great. Question.
Thank you. My name is Peter Joe Sanchez. I have a question for you. Einstein, as you pointed out in his theory of relativity, you know, says everything depends on your point of view. Mm-hmm. Now, you spent 4 years putting this book together, which I purchased today.
Thank you.
Looking forward to getting your signature on it, and I will read it in detail. Now, when you're assembling this thing, I would like to know something about your background. Do you believe in the soul? Are you like religious in any way? Or are you an agnostic or an atheist? I mean, this will help me understand the fulcrum through which you
right.
see these things.
I think I'm an atheist. I guess the way I said that makes me sound like an agnostic. But I don't believe in the soul, no. I don't believe in the soul, but I think, as you'll discover when you read the book, that I try and handle religious ideas with a certain amount of respect. I think that the sort of discourse with which we talk about believers, the way non-believers talk about believers is a problem, and I try and give their ideas the same respect, you know, as in here that I give to John Locke and Aristotle.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you talk about the belief, you know, that people have and respecting it, but it seems that you know, that's the default state for most human beings to think, and most scientific groups also believe in whatever their basic assumptions are, mm-hmm. and really can't describe them either, even though that's not scientific.
Yeah.
It's not rational. It's just kind of a default way that we do almost everything. There are certainly plenty of scientists who don't do that.
Yeah.
But there's plenty who just, you know, you can't discuss these ideas because they're already all settled.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of people in here who held what they described, and we would probably describe as distinctly secular beliefs about how the world works, and they were sort of shouted down everywhere they went in America as atheists, who hold their supposedly rational beliefs with a distinctly religious quality. They're religious about their socialism.
Yeah, were there many people grouped, you know, kicked out of the groups? I mean, there must usually these communities have people who begin to not believe, and the first ones who begin to not believe are usually asked to leave.
Yes, some of them were asked to leave. Sometimes they successfully ruined everything.
First, I'd like to compliment you on your writing. When you were reading, I found it really deep and moving, and I thought it was really
well-researched and penetrating. It was really great stuff. I'm really glad you read from the book. I'm curious about what the legacy might have been in the shorter term for the utopian societies. So when I think about the late 19th century and I think about successful progressive movements, both in terms of social movements, but also in terms of labor movements, there's a lot of progress made between like 1890 and 1925 or so. And I'm curious whether any of that was linked or if it was just, you know, because a lot of times grand ideas that are put forward move an entire society's thinking to one direction. And while they don't achieve what they achieve, sort of as it slides back to the middle, there's a more reasonable achievement that considered by society reasonable, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, is there I do entirely. Another historian whose name now escapes me used the word irradiates. These communities, when they fell apart, sort of sent people out into the rest of the country with these then radical ideas, like women's equality being sort of the most obvious, that ended up moving the country forward. And in some specific cases, there were people who went on to be very successful reformers. In fact, one of the biggest blows to the American utopianism, and I mean that sort of ironically because I think it was a good thing, was the sort of rise of the abolitionist movement. A lot of the same people, a lot of the same sort of dollars and column inches that had been flowing into these organizations were redirected into the abolitionist movement. And then Robert Owen went back to England and became the sort of leader of the English labor movement. So to use a specific example that you mentioned. Oh yeah, here there was a lot of tension in the North between you know white working class white workers in the North were strongly opposed to the Civil War and to the abolitionist movement. And in fact, to the shame of the utopians, though it's not really their fault, a couple of, if you can call them intellectuals, pro-slavery theorists quoted at length these people, Fourier and Robert Owen, to make their case, because Fourier and Robert Owen composed such good critiques of industrial capitalism, that they would sort of quote these people and say, look, the North has no business lecturing the South on slavery, and the phrase wage slavery came into circulation to draw what I think is a ridiculous analogy between you know people working in factories in the North and people who are actual property in the South.
We have time for one more question.
What you describe sounds like a utopianism founded mainly on religious ideas having to do with millennialism, end of days, and so on. But in the 19th century in the U.S., there were a lot of other religious movements that were not communist-oriented, if you will. Or,
sure.
And what's the relation between these... you know, and some of them exist to this day, you know, many of them actually.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of rapport between these people and those people. And it's hard to refer to these as religious ideas. Some of them were, I mean, the Shakers were very explicitly religious. The Oneida community had strong religious ideas, but all of them really were blending secular sort of political, philosophical ideas with religious ideas. So I don't want to call them just religious communities. But yeah, there was a lot of rapport and towards the very end of the century, in the beginning of the 20th century, is when pre-millenarian Christianity and theology, I think, begins to grow, and which leads, I think, very much to the fundamentalist movement and the evangelical movement were hinged on that switch from a belief on how the end of the world was going to play out. But these people were very much talking with one another, yeah.
So you're saying that the remnant is the remnant of these communities?
No.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, for a great talk. And Chris's book is available in the lobby if you'd like to buy a copy and have it signed. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.